It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the disagreement between the Ho-Chunk and the Stockbridge-Muncie community over a casino expansion in Shawano County. First, the United States dropped the largest non-nuclear bomb in its arsenal on an ISIS stronghold in eastern Afghanistan yesterday. Here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer announcing the strike.
At around 7 p.m. local time in Afghanistan last night, the United States military used a GBU-43 weapon in Afghanistan. The GBU-43 is a large, powerful, and accurately delivered weapon. We targeted a system of tunnels and caves that ISIS fighters used to move around freely, making it easier for them to target U.S. military advisors and Afghan forces in the area. The United States takes the fight against ISIS very seriously, and in order to defeat the group, we must deny them operational space, which we did. The United States took all precautions necessary to prevent civilian casualties and collateral damage as a result of the operation.
The offensive comes just days after the U.S. launched a retaliatory missile strike against a Syrian airbase from which Syrian planes had attacked civilians with banned chemical weapons. Saeed Khan joins us now. He's a lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, in your words, Saeed, can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, basically what happened, as the reports leading up were mentioning, this was the largest non-nuclear ordnance in the American arsenal, a bomb which weighs 10.5 tons, or roughly 21,000 pounds. And it is a bomb that actually was so large that it had to be dropped from a cargo plane, an American C-130 transport plane, and it explodes just above the ground, and it is a concussive device which obliterates everything up to 1,000 yards. Up to 1 mile, it knocks down all people, tents, light buildings, cars, and jeeps. Up to 1.7 miles, the shockwave can kill people and cause severe damage to buildings and equipment to the point where it can blow trucks and tanks right off the road. Up to 2 miles, it can shatter eardrums and cause deafness. Up to 5 miles away, it can break windows and shake the ground. And a 10,000-foot mushroom cloud can be seen up to 30 miles away. The target ostensibly was tunnels that are used by ISIS-K, and the K stands for Khorasan, which means it's Central Asian branch.
Now, as I understand it, an earlier model of this bomb was built in 2003, intended to be used in the war in Iraq, but it was not used, not until yesterday. So why use it now?
Well, that's, of course, the big question that everyone is asking, is that at this particular moment, and what seems to be a rather improbable location, why would the U.S. Military deploy it here? And I think that there's a couple of things that we can go ahead and try to explore. One, the remoteness, relatively speaking, of this area, and taking the military and the Afghans on the ground at their word, there were no civilian casualties that have been reported so far, and yet at the same time, it was an ISIS target. So what it shows is, first of all, that ISIS is operating outside Iraq and Syria, which is, of course, the epicenter. And so this could be seen as a way to make sure that we can contain ISIS into that part of the Middle East. At the same time, of course, we have to go ahead and concede that the fact that there is, according to military intelligence, a presence of ISIS in Afghanistan is troubling because it is now metastasized. And, of course, it also then brings back this entire narrative that the United States is going back into Afghanistan. But I think we have to also consider to whom is a message being sent with such a large munition. And given its capacity of being able to, again, ostensibly target underground tunnels, as in this case, it is a kind of weapon that could be used to ferret nuclear programs, which for many countries are underground, like in the case of North Korea.
Do we know whether the United States has achieved its military goals with this strike?
There is no evidence of that, and part of it, of course, is going to be how the United States or its allies in the area can even reach the particular area and can go ahead and make an assessment of what was there prior to the explosion and what is there now. After all, if the stated goal was to try to reach and neutralize underground tunnels, well, that's something that cannot be seen even from our most sophisticated spy satellites because they are underground. So it's going to be a real question to see how then the military is going to explain what is its metric of success in this particular campaign.
And President Trump hasn't explicitly said that he authorized this strike, but here's what he did say.
We are so proud of our military, and it was another successful event.
Did you authorize it, sir?
Everybody knows exactly what happened, so... And what I do is I authorize my military. We have the greatest military in the world, and they've done a job as usual. So we have given them total authorization, and that's what they're doing. And frankly, that's why they've been so successful lately.
Syed, what do you make of that response? He authorized the military, not expressly the strike itself.
Well, that's really strange, given that the president has a penchant for taking credit for everything, especially the more grandiose that it is. And I think it's important to remember that during his campaign, he was certainly one to talk in very, very exaggerated terms about how he wanted to bomb the expletive deleted out of ISIS. So this is clearly an example of him doing so, and I'm sure that he will probably mention this on the campaign trail. But as far as how the military itself is involved, this seems to be a decision that was made primarily by the military, those who are coordinating the strikes in Afghanistan itself out of the Pentagon. But clearly, as commander-in-chief, he would have had to have given the full authorization. Whether he did so for this specific munition, that still seems to be a bit ambiguous.
Syed Khan is with us right now from Wayne State University talking about the U.S. strike against ISIS in eastern Afghanistan yesterday. And Syed, how unusual is it for a president to say what President Trump did in this case, that he did not authorize the strike?
Well, again, I think what we're dealing with here is nuance. The president wants to be very clear that he is not opening up a brand new theater of Afghanistan, because after all, one of his prior statements and criticisms of then-President Obama was the former president's military involvement in so many different arenas. And so it's ironic now that all of the places where the United States was under the Obama administration and what had been President Trump's pledge to become a little bit more isolationist has in fact changed dramatically, particularly over the last couple of weeks. The fact that the United States has had strikes in Iraq, Syria, and now Afghanistan show that the U.S. is re-engaged in those arenas, and yet at the same time it seems as though President Trump is conflicted about whether he wants to in fact admit that we are now again back in Afghanistan.
So given that there has been this re-engagement, does it represent an escalation or just a change in course in terms of President Trump's foreign policy as regards maybe isolationism?
Well, clearly, I mean, with the incident in Syria last week of bombing the air base as a response to the chemical weapons strike in Syria, with added engagement in Iraq, and now in the case of Afghanistan, one cannot go ahead and deny that the American military presence is re-engaged, and some would argue would never really left the battlefield. At the same time, I think what we have here with President Trump is a conflict of trying to align campaign rhetoric with statesman rhetoric, going from isolationism to now a more robust global policeman posture. At the same time, we don't know how much further he will go in Afghanistan. Right now, there does not seem to be any real word coming out of the Pentagon for the redeployment of troops. In Syria, there are rumblings about whether or not there's going to be the dispatching of ground troops, but nothing has been concretized yet. And the same is in Iraq. If these issues can be handled through airstrikes, whether those are are drones which have persisted now for several years, or from these shock and awe measures, that seems to be the more willing comfort zone for the president than getting into another quagmire as what he criticized his predecessor for having been and putting the United States into.
There have been reports that President Trump is giving more latitude to military leaders in various spots of engagement around the world. Have we seen that playing out, and how might that differ from what we've seen so far?
Well, that would explain why President Trump is a little bit reticent to go ahead and take full credit for the deployment of the Moab bomb in Afghanistan. It seems as though these decisions are being made and the deferment to the military, to the Pentagon, whether in Northern Virginia or out in the field, is part of the foreign policy strategy right now. It seems as though for President Trump, these are matters that he does not want to micromanage, and he wants to leave it to the experts, at least right now, in deploying the U.S. military where it's going.
Saeed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Saeed Khan is a lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He joined us to talk about the U.S. strike against ISIS in Afghanistan. We're getting an update on the fight between the Ho-Chunk and the Stockbridge-Munsee community over Ho-Chunk Casino expansion in Shawnee County. Earlier this week, host Kate Archer-Kent talked to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Jason Stein about the latest.
Well, bring us to the heart of this casino expansion debate. What's going on here?
Right. So the Ho-Chunk, for quite a while, have had a secondary or ancillary casino at Wittenberg, and they want to expand it. They're in the midst of doing a very large expansion, and it has alarmed a nearby tribe, the Stockbridge-Munsee, who have their only casino in that area and are concerned that they will see their main source of revenue for their pretty financially modest tribe greatly impacted by this expansion.
They funded a survey. They found that they would lose $22 million a year through this expansion by the Ho-Chunk.
Right. I mean, that's their contention. I think the Ho-Chunk would dispute that, but I mean, I think there's no doubt that there would be a significant impact to having this large expansion nearby. The Ho-Chunk are expanding, you know, again, a secondary facility that's one of several they have around the state. You know, in some cases, these secondary casinos or ancillary casinos are little more than a small collection of slot machines in a gas station. So, you know, and this certainly to look at, if you've seen the facility, if you've seen the site, I mean, this is going to have the look of a pretty decent sized, the pretty significant casino and hotel.
Hundreds of slot machines.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So who decides whether or not the Ho-Chunk can expand? Can they do this in Shawnee County?
Right. And obviously the Ho-Chunk are going to say that they're just simply pursuing a business opportunity like any tribe. It's a combination of factors. The federal government has a role in regulating Native American casinos and gambling, and the state government does too through agreements called compacts that the state has signed over many years with tribes like the Ho-Chunk and the Stockbridge. And the Stockbridge are giving every indication that they are going to sue the state of Wisconsin and the Ho-Chunk for, you know, sort of not complying with state agreements and federal rules in an attempt to get this expansion stopped.
And there's apparently this deed that dates back to 1969.
Right. So it's complex, but the case will hinge on, you know, this likely lawsuit will hinge on whether or not the proper procedures were handled to qualify this property to have a casino on site, as well as whether or not having such a large casino where, you know, there's going to be such a large amount of slot machine revenue, whether or not that really complies with the agreement that the Ho-Chunk struck with the state. And this is more than just two tribes at issue, because the Ho-Chunk are not the only tribe that has ancillary casinos. The Oneida and also some Ojibwe tribes have them. And so there's always the possibility that if the Ho-Chunk succeed in this, that another tribe might look at that and say, you know what, we'd like to do the same thing.
What leverage does the Stockbridge-Munsee have in this argument?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing that they have, I think, that everyone should note is that they have a lot to lose. And the one thing about any actor that, you know, when you're talking about an individual or a corporation or a sovereign nation, like an Indian tribe, if their only or main source of revenue or livelihood is threatened, you know, you can't expect that person to use every tool at their disposal to sort of fight to maintain their revenue and their livelihood, right? And, I mean, it certainly seems as if that is the case. The Stockbridge claim that they have a pretty good case. The state, you know, very vigorously disputes that and claims that, you know, they have to let the Ho-Chunk move forward, that they don't really have any choice given the rules in place. And, you know, I do think that we'll get a court to decide on that because, again, given the likely losses that the Stockbridge have, it's likely that they'll feel compelled to take some sort of action.
We're talking right now with Jason Stein. He's State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the Ho-Chunk Casino expansion of its Wittenberg facility in Shawano County and the dispute of this by the Stockbridge-Munsee community, who are disputing this expansion of an ancillary casino. Jason, I was reading the survey that the Stockbridge-Munsee community that they did this survey, a Chicago outfit did the survey, saying tribes take in $1.2 billion after paying winnings each year. That's a lot of money out there.
Sure. It is a, you know, Native American gambling is a very significant, you know, economic issue in the state. You know, and at the same time, though, you know, it appears that gambling is a pretty mature industry in the state. In other words, that it's not necessarily growing by leaps and bounds the overall pie. And so, you know, when you have a proposal like the former proposal by the Menominee to put a casino in Kenosha, which failed, or this latest expansion, other tribes look at that as something that may take from their share of the pie because they don't necessarily expect the pie to get a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the survey said that Wisconsin is a truly saturated market.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can always sort of argue to what extent. I mean, you know, in the case of Kenosha, there you might have had some people drive up from Chicago and you know, some new visitors to the state. Obviously, when you're talking about a casino at Wittenberg, you know, more in the center of the state, it doesn't seem nearly as likely that someone would, you know, drive hours from out of state to visit that casino. So it's probably going to be drawing for its customer base on, you know, people that live in the region and that already have some options for, you know, gambling if that's something they want to do for entertainment.
How have state officials weighed in on this conflict? What do we know from the state?
Right. So the state has said basically that given the law, given the agreements that have been signed, they argue that the Ho-Chunk are in the right to do that. They have the legal right to do this, and that it's essentially something that the state doesn't have any business stepping into. One argument that's being made by Republican lawmakers in that area is that some Republican lawmakers are asking Governor Scott Walker's administration to go out and get a second legal opinion, if you will, from an outside counsel, essentially saying, you know, we're concerned about this issue and we think we might be sued anyway, so we think it makes sense to go out and make sure that we're on firm legal ground before we find ourselves in a federal courtroom.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the Stockbridge-Munsee have withheld almost a $1 million payment to the state that's due June 30th?
Right. They have said they're going to withhold their revenue sharing payment to the state of Wisconsin. Obviously, because they are, in economic terms, a relatively small tribe compared to the Ho-Chunk, that is not as significant as if you had, the Potawatomi, Oneida, or Ho-Chunk tribes withholding money from the state. But it's certainly, I think, speaks to how serious the tribe appears to be about this issue and how they are, likely going to go to, I think, court and see if they win or lose. Maybe not because they're super excited to do that, but because if you look at the other options that they might have, their elected leaders, it's going to be very difficult, I think, for them to go to their members, their tribal members, and say, look, we just have to cut, 10, 15, 20% of our budget, and that's the way it is. We don't have any other option.
Jason, what happens next in this situation?
Well, the Stockbridge-Munsee tribe has made some very preliminary filings in federal court, not filing a lawsuit, but essentially laying the groundwork for a lawsuit. And so, at this point, they certainly could be a movement either by the state or by the Ho-Chunk tribe that could change the situation. But, right now, the Ho-Chunk tribe is moving forward with construction, and that, I think, has lended a lot of urgency on both sides of the issue. So, it appears as if in the near future there will be a lawsuit brought against the state. We'll see.
Jason, thanks so much for the update.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Appreciate being on.
That was Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Kate Archer Kent earlier this week about the latest news in the Ho-Chunk Stockbridge-Munsee debate over a casino expansion in Shawano County. You can find a link to that story on the Central Time Facebook page. Most of us know that we should be getting at least 8 hours sleep, drinking several glasses of water, eating healthy meals loaded with fruits and veggies. But doing all that isn't always easy, especially because most of us just don't have that much time. And that's probably why you're seeing everyone from busy parents to wellness experts making their food for the week in advance. In other words, meal prepping. People are turning to meal prepping to save time, money, and keep their health goals on track. America's Test Kitchen is compiling meal prep recipes in the forthcoming book, The Complete Make-Ahead Cookbook. Stephanie Pixley is a senior editor there, and she joins us now. Excuse me, Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad to talk to you.
Well, Stephanie, what are the benefits of making meals ahead of time?
Well, the benefits, as you mentioned, are that you can save time, you can save money, you can save stress. If you're able to prioritize your meals, you'll be a happier person, I think.
So you think it actually makes you happier?
Absolutely. If you have more time to do fun stuff that you'd rather be doing if you're not into cooking, then I think you'd be a happier person.
We were just talking about this before the interview started. Is it really a time savings? Because it does take time to prep those meals, maybe on a Sunday night, say, or a Saturday afternoon. So when it all comes out in the wash, are you ahead of the game?
I think you end up ahead of the game for sure. I mean, if you're spending a little bit of time in the morning to get a steak rubbed with a salt spice rub, then that means in the afternoon you don't have to spend that time and you can focus on other things. So it's all about finding when you have the time to figure out what's going to happen for dinner tonight.
Well, who do you think this concept of meal prepping is most useful to? Who's using it?
I think literally anyone could use this. Before starting this book, we actually surveyed home cooks and asked them how make-ahead cooking fits into their lifestyle. And what we learned was that really everyone has their own perspective. So we tried to include as much make-ahead information in our book with each recipe. So, for example, a dinner could be something that you make completely ahead and then just reheat the night of, or you prep it beforehand and then you just throw it in the oven. So it's really about figuring out what works best for you.
Are there particular types of meals that lend themselves especially well to this, salads or casseroles, or can you find a way to meal prep almost anything?
You know, you'd be really surprised. You can find a way to meal prep really anything. I mean, you can do dessert. You can freeze a tiramisu. You can do a salad, like just a mixed green salad and a make-ahead vinaigrette and take it to work for lunch the next day. Or you can do your classic casserole. You can freeze a lasagna and bake it up the next day. It really is anything.
Well, let's go through some of the basics. What are some of the essential storing techniques and maybe the kind of equipment you might need to get this done?
Yeah, well, having good freezer bags and plastic or glass storage containers is really important if you want to be a successful prep-ahead cook. I know that I take the public transportation to work every day, and I've had many mornings where I've gotten to work and opened my bag, and the item that I brought to work that I spent so much time on just spilled out in my bag. So making sure that you have something that you trust to store is really important. So freezer bags are good if you're going to freeze, but also just for anything. And plastic or glass storage containers that snap tight is also really nice.
We have an especially avid meal prepper on the staff here at Central Time. In fact, She's the one who reached out to you, and she loves mason jars. What are your thoughts on the kind of mason jar craze?
Oh, yeah, they're super cute, and they're easy to store. They're easy to clean. They're perfect for vinaigrettes. You can just screw the lid on, take it to work, and then shake it in the lid to go later. You can even do really cute desserts in mason jars. They're really awesome.
So are we going to be sacrificing flavor and freshness by doing this? We get some convenience, but we're paying for it on the taste end of things.
If you do it right, no. One of the things that we really tried to do in developing this book was to make sure that we were making a fresh batch of whatever it is we were making ahead to taste side by side next to the made ahead version to make sure that we weren't sacrificing any quality. So we would literally freeze something for a month and then make something fresh and taste them side by side just to make sure.
Really? And they came out neck and neck?
Yeah. Yep. And if they didn't, then we tweaked the recipe. And if it didn't work, then we didn't include it.
Now, this idea of meal prepping is something that's really caught on with the fitness community. Why is it especially helpful when you're trying to get to those wellness goals?
Well, I think that something that a lot of people struggle with is time. And at the end of the day, if you have spent your day hectically running around between meetings and you get home and you're tired and you really just don't have the energy to put a meal on the table, a lot of the time people turn to takeout or frozen entrees, which really aren't that healthy. They're loaded in sodium or fat or hidden sugars. And if you take the time to prep your meal ahead, then you won't have to be tired and lazy because you've already done the work. So you just throw whatever it is in the oven or toss it with a vinaigrette or whatever.
Talking right now with Stephanie Pixley, Senior Books Editor at America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about meal prepping, that is to say meals that you can make in advance and they'll feed you for the next few days or maybe a week. And Stephanie, salads seem to have been kind of tricky. Mm-hmm. In the past, we knew that you could, some people said, well, if you prep your greens and put some paper towels, it will absorb the moisture. But in general, it seems like salads don't always keep that well. What do we need to know about how to make a salad ahead of time?
Well, one of the big keys to knowing how to make a salad ahead of time is knowing what you can and cannot include. So, you know, if you're going to make a salad, it's probably not a great idea to put delicate things in your salad like watercress. However, roasted butternut squash is really great in a salad because it lasts really well. All you have to do is bring it to room temperature. Another thing that we learned actually was the way that you store your salad is really important. So if you're putting together a mixed green salad, it's actually really important to put the heartier and heavier ingredients at the bottom of your container or bowl and put more delicate ingredients like greens or herbs at the top. You also want to make sure that you keep wet ingredients like soft cheeses away from other ingredients that need to stay crisp and dry like nuts, just so that the nuts don't absorb the moisture from the cheese and then lose their flavor and crispness.
So are you saying that we don't have to do it salad bar style where you've got your little pouches of every single ingredient? We can put it all on top, just we have to layer it the right way?
Exactly, yeah. And you can do millions of variations of this, of a simple salad. You can do any fruit, any cheese, any greens. It's really up to you.
And you shared several recipes with us. Those are up, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page right now, if you want to take a look. And let's talk about one of the salads right now. You've got a recipe for spinach and frisée with blueberries, feta, and almonds. Sounds like a pretty gourmet salad, and you say we can do this one ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. The key to that is exactly what I said, putting the blueberries at the bottom of the bowl and then topping that with frisée and feta, spinach, and then all the way at the top is the almonds. You can store it that way for up to 24 hours before you dress and serve it.
And you've also got a vinaigrette recipe. And here's a tricky thing that I struggle with. I feel like if I bring a little container of homemade dressing, I have to slosh it around and see if I can get it to emulsify. You have a trick for that here with your make-ahead vinaigrette. What is it?
Yeah, this make-ahead vinaigrette is miraculous. It stays emulsified for several days thanks to the combination of emulsifiers of mustard and mayonnaise. And it also has a stabilizer in there. It has molasses. So it will, and another thing is that it won't solidify in the refrigerator thanks to the combination of extra virgin olive oil and vegetable oil. So there's like three tricks in there to make this the most miraculous make-ahead vinaigrette you'll ever have.
And how does it taste?
Delicious, of course.
So it's a vinaigrette, and does it taste like, I don't know, molasses, gingerbready?
No, not really. It's only a tablespoon of molasses, and it makes a full cup. So it just adds a little bit more depth of flavor, and it makes sure that the vinaigrette doesn't separate.
Stephanie Pixley stays with us. She's senior books editor at America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about meal prepping, meals you can make in advance. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page. What questions do you have about meal prepping? Is there something that you've tried before and it works pretty well? Something you'd like advice for? And does it help you stay healthy, to eat healthier during a busy week? Call us at 800-642-1234. We're picking up our conversation with Stephanie Pixley from America's Test Kitchen, looking at recipes that you can make ahead and keep stocked in your fridge. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you need meal prepping ideas for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. What meals do you like to cook ahead for the entire week? And tell us if meal prepping has saved you time or money or helped you be a healthier person, leading a healthier life. Our number is 800-642-1234. And we take our first caller. We have Anita with us from Gurnee, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi, delightful program.
Thank you.
We noticed a few years ago that we're using a lot of the same preparation ingredients in many of our recipes. And that would be fresh garlic and different colors of organic peppers and basil. And we use a lot of olive oil. And so it's always that prep time that dissuades us, oh, maybe we won't make that tonight, you know. So what we decided was we get a whole bunch of the peppers together and we prep them. We keep a few of them out fresh for a salad and the rest go in Ziplocs in the freezer. And then the other thing is we'll prepare a lot of fresh garlic, and it goes in a glass jar in the fridge. And the other thing is to take a cupcake baking pan, and we've cut up a bunch of basil and put that down in those little cups and then fill the rest with olive oil. Mm. And then those go, when they're frozen, into a Ziploc. So if we're preparing a piece of chicken or fish, let's say, we can just take one or two of those little things out and plop them right on top of the fish or the chicken, and it takes care of itself in the oven. You don't even need to leave, you know, add any extra olive oil. And then the peppers, we just take them out of the freezer. The garlic's already made. There's none of that prep and mess and 1,000 dishes to wash. So
wow.
It turned out really, really great. We don't make the whole meal, but that heavy time-consuming prep is handled that way.
Anita, you are organized. That sounds
fantastic.
And I like the idea of peeling garlic ahead of time. That's one that always seems I'll roll my eyes if I'm not in the right mood, and then I'll reach for a frozen pizza instead. So what do you think about some of those ideas, Stephanie?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think something that I always like to do is when I get home from the grocery store is to prep my vegetables as much as possible. So like you do with your peppers, prepping them and putting them in Ziploc bags or storage containers, that's a really quick and easy way to get ahead of the dinner game without a lot of effort on the front end. Same thing with heads of lettuce. I take them home, I prep them, I wash them, and I store them in wrapped in damp paper towels and Ziploc bags in the crisper drawer, and they last so much longer than those boxes of pre-washed greens.
And do you chop them up if you've got a head of lettuce, or do you just kind of rinse
them
up?
Yeah, I do. I usually do, just to make it happen, get it done, get one step closer.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about another recipe you shared with us, and this is another one up on the Central Time Facebook page. And in this case, we're talking about mixed greens with asparagus and shredded carrots.
Yes, this is a great one for this time of year when we're finally getting some vegetables again. I love this recipe because it's raw asparagus. So the only thing that you do is cut it, which is amazing. So you layer your carrots and your asparagus at the bottom of the bowl and then put your lettuce on top of that. It's a similar method to what we did with the spinach and frisée salad, but you just make sure that you don't bruise the delicate mesclun greens.
That sounds good. So veggies, getting some great ideas for how to get ahead on these veggies. And you shared another recipe with us where I was a little surprised. I thought this is not something that you make ahead of time. This is a day of labor intensive thing, smoked salmon and leek tart. But you say we can do it ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah, this one actually has a lot of make ahead potential to it. It's a beautiful, beautiful dish that is great for an Easter brunch or just any breakfast gathering with friends. It's a showstopper for sure. But there are several make-ahead aspects to this. So the crust itself, you can make ahead. You can make the crust and freeze it. You can make the crust and line your tart shell and freeze it. Or you can even bake your crust and let it sit at room temperature for 24 hours. And then you can even make your tart ahead of time. So you can bake your tart and let it sit at room temperature for 4 hours before topping it with this salmon, chive, oil mixture, or you can bake your tart and refrigerate it for up to 24 hours ahead of time. So there's so many options for making this one ahead. We really tried to make sure that anyone who would pick up our book would be able to find something that they could fit into their lifestyle. So whether you're trying to do something far ahead of time or if you're just looking for a couple extra hours the day of, anything helps.
Stephanie Pixley is with us right now from America's Test Kitchen, and she's giving us some excellent ideas for meal prepping, getting it done ahead of time, maybe the kind of thing you do on a Sunday night or after a trip to the farmer's market or the store. And it turns out, Stephanie says, you can do almost anything, at least some components ahead of time, to save yourself some work down the week. We talked about prepping produce, and we want to know what you do to meal prep, to get ready for the week, to get ready for how you're going to feed yourself and your family, those lunches, those breakfasts. What do you do? And what techniques, what storage have you found? And do you have any particular recipes that you think work especially well when you're meal prepping? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Stephanie, what can we do to make sure that we're not eating the same meals over and over every single week?
That's a tough one. Yeah, people tend to get stuck in ruts for sure. I think one of the best things you can do is to try to eat seasonally. So go to the grocery store and see what's new in the market, in the produce section. That's something that I like to do because it forces you to be creative and it forces you to change up your habits. So even if it is a lasagna again, you can switch up what you're putting in your lasagna. So in the deep winter, maybe it's just a tomato and cheese lasagna. But in the summertime, having like a fresh tomato a fresh vegetable lasagna is something bright and different.
And you think it sounds like you were saying lasagnas freeze pretty well.
Oh yeah, of course. Everyone knows that though.
Is there anything special we need to do? I mean, when I think back to my grandmother who wrapped things in 9 different layers of plastic and tinfoil, and sometimes it still tasted like freezer burn. What do we need to do to not have that happen, to have it taste fresh?
Well, your grandmother was actually onto something. She wrapping it in plastic wrap is a good idea, but then wrapping it in foil is actually also a good idea. We found that the foil layer actually helps to prevent the lasagna from picking up off odors that of other foods in your freezer. But I think probably the most important thing is to not leave a lasagna in your freezer for a year and to eat it within 1 or 2 months. So a really important tip, if you're the type of make-ahead cook that likes to stock your freezer, is to put really clear labels on your food. So write what it is and the date that you made it on a piece of tape or something like that, and put it directly on the dish, just so that when you're pawing through and you see, oh, this is from 2015, you know, it's probably not going to be the best, so don't serve it to company.
Good idea. Label it all. And we've got a caller now. Tim is joining us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. So I was raised in a large family, and because of that, I cook very good food, but I can't cook small. So when I make pasta sauce, I make somewhere between a gallon and 5 gallons of pasta sauce.
So you're making a lot of pasta sauce.
I don't know how to cook small. The recipes, they just don't scale properly. And my question is, I've tried freezing it before, which turns out just fine, but if I were to can the pasta sauces, how long can I actually expect these things to last? Because if I make 5 gallons and there's just 3 of us having, you know, a pasta sauce-sized pasta, kind of makes sense, or a canning jar size of pasta sauce kind of makes sense. But, you know, if there's meat, there's that kind of stuff in there, how long can I expect it to last?
Oh, interesting question, Tim. So if he's canning his gallons and gallons of pasta sauce, how long can he expect it to last?
That is a good question. You know, I think the point of canning is so that it lasts for a while. And I think generally people can when items are at their peak in season. So tomato sauces, you're probably canning in the middle of the summer. I think the best bet is to can for a year out. So in your summertime, make enough stuff to last you a year, and then the next summer, make another batch of that stuff.
Great, Tim. Well, good luck with your vats of tomato sauce. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. And let's go to Scott in Windsor. Scott, you're up. Hi.
Hi. This is a great show. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
I just want to, maybe you can speak to it or not, your guest can speak to it, but I've become a real aficionado of sous vide cooking to speed meal prep. You can set up a steak. I'm going to do a chuck roast for Easter dinner this week, and I'm going to start that soon, and then in about 36 hours, I'm going to be able to take it out, sear it off, and I'm done on Easter Sunday.
Okay, Scott, you're going to have to tell me what sous vide cooking is.
Oh, sous vide cooking is, I have a water circulator. I converted an old Coleman cooler to hold the water. The circulator sits down in there, and it has precision temperature control. You can cook your steak, your ribeye, to 129.6 degrees if you want. And it's done edge to edge, and then you just sear it off and serve it up, and it's the best steak you've ever had.
Wow.
I guarantee it.
I'm learning something new.
Yeah,
Stephanie, what about that? Sous vide cooking.
Yeah, it's a really fun way of cooking. A lot of people are getting into it right now. There's a lot of new types of sous vide sticks and water circulators that are on the market right now. So I don't know a ton about it, but what's your question?
There's no question. It's just the, you know, if you have any vegetables and things like vegetables are hard to do. Sous vide.
Absolutely. You know, another thing that's really great to do with sous vide is cooking seafood. I think people have a really hard time cooking seafood and knowing when it's done, especially if they don't have an instant read thermometer. So if you can put a beautiful piece of fish in your sous vide and know that it's going to be perfect, that gives people a lot of peace of mind.
Wow. Well, Scott, thank you for that. And clearly we're going to have to do a show about sous vide cooking now that I've learned what it is. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us and talking about meal prep today.
Absolutely. I was glad to talk to you.
That was Stephanie Pixley, Senior Books Editor at America's Test Kitchen, joining us to talk about meal prepping and share some recipes from the forthcoming book, The Complete Make-Ahead Cookbook. And don't forget, we have 4 recipes, maybe a couple more up on the Central Time Facebook page for you to take a look at and give a try this coming week. Good luck. Star Wars fans are having a pretty good day. The trailer for The Last Jedi debuted today at Star Wars Celebration in Orlando. Well, sure, we did have Rogue One to fill in some of the backstories in Star Wars, like what was up with the Bothans. But The Last Jedi is the next official film in the Star Wars franchise. And we're starting to get hints about what's up with Rey and Finn and Kylo Ren. There are space battles, looks like, naturally. And Rey also seems to be getting lessons about how to use the Force from Mark Hamill as Luke.
I only know one truth. It's time for the Jedi to end.
So it's a little unclear exactly who is saying it's time for the Jedi, dramatic pause, to end, which means that we just have to sit it out until December when Star Wars 8 opens in theaters. This is Central Time.